add Europe and the Middle East to the list. 3 months into the coronavirus outbreak, the illness is spreading far beyond China. But Asia remains the epicenter, and South Koreans are on high alert.
So I've noticed that a lot of people have been walking into this pharmacy and coming out with bags and bags of face masks.
Also, the U.S. wants Julian Assange back to the U.S. to stand trial. His supporters in London reject the U.S. extradition claim.
It is not a crime to publish American war crimes.
And a middle-aged Zamboni driver in Toronto gets the word, lace up your skates, you're playing goalie in the NHL tonight.
When I saw the text message, this guy's playing with me right now, like I'm going in.
Those stories and more today here on The World. Hi, Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is great to have you with us. We're starting to hear talk of the word pandemic. The coronavirus outbreak is now rapidly expanding in parts of the Middle East and Europe, in addition to Asia. The World Health Organization urges countries to be prepared. The World's Alana Gordon covers public health and is tracking the developments.
So there's a few different things going on right now, some of which might seem to conflict when you look at it. So I want to start in China. Over the weekend, President Xi Jinping said that this new coronavirus, it represents their biggest public health threat. And at the same time, the disease appears to have peaked last month and even plateaued in the places at the epicenter of this whole thing. So here's Mi Feng with China's National Health Commission speaking this morning through a translator.
We have seen an ever decline of the new confirmed cases and new onsets. As of today, we can see this continuous trend, in particular when it is compared.
So it's a little hard to hear, but essentially they've seen a decline.
Right.
And the WHO delegation has actually been in China this week. They said that these containment measures have really helped prevent a lot of new cases there. And they're even seeing this decline again in Wuhan. This is the place where the whole thing began.
Right. So this is a good thing.
Yeah. The director of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said today, yeah, it appears to be a good sign.
The key message that should give all countries hope, courage, and confidence is that this virus can be contained.
But at the same time, Marco, outside of China, as you mentioned earlier, we're seeing a lot more countries with cases. Now it's at about 28. And there's new potential outbreaks. And Dr. Tedros said that uptick in infections is, quote, deeply concerning.
Yeah. So what is this spread to other countries really all about?
Well, it varies from place to place. So Italy's now seen and experienced the highest number of cases outside Asia. Over the weekend, cases spiked from just a handful to at least 150, and that includes a few deaths also. And the government there has put in some pretty sweeping restrictions in areas to the north near Milan and Venice. And so it means that like tens of thousands of people can't go in and out of there without special permission. South Korea has also experienced a big jump in cases. And then there's the Middle East. Iran has been the highest profile. There's been several dozen cases, at least a dozen deaths, and that's happening during a time of religious gatherings there. It's even prompted several countries like Pakistan and Turkey to close their borders with Iran.
So given the spread of COVID-19 to other countries now, does this mean that we're in the midst of a pandemic?
So whether to use that P word, Marco, has been coming up more and more. Dr. Mike Ryan, who's head of the WHO's Health Emergency Program, he was talking today just about the very meaning of that word.
Pandemic comes, I think, from the Greek pandemos, which means everybody. Demos meaning the population, pan meaning everyone. So pandemos is a concept where there's a belief that the whole world's population would likely be exposed to this infection.
So that's more or less the definition of a pandemic. The implication is that it has a global spread around the world, big human impacts of widespread infections and deaths. And the WHO, they've been reviewing all the impact of this COVID-19, its severity, its geographic spread. And what they say at this point, no, it's not a pandemic. Dr. Ryan even says that the context of understanding where and how these new cases are popping up is key. So if you look at some of the new cases right now in China, a lot of the transmission is happening between family members.
You see with Singapore, when they had a cluster at a conference, there was exportation from that conference. You've seen in the case of Iran, religious gatherings. So sometimes when you see an acceleration of cases and a spread from that it doesn't necessarily represent the natural transmission dynamics of the virus. It's very much driven by the context.
But does it have the potential to become a pandemic?
It does.
Yeah.
I mean, so much can happen in the next days and weeks. A lot remains to be seen. Some risk specialists say it should be viewed as a pandemic already. But there's also this worry that this term, the way the public interprets that term, could lead to an unnecessary fear and overreaction. So Mike Ryan with WHO says every place can't all close your borders. The world can't just totally shut down. And that also wouldn't stop the spread of a disease. So he says what is clear right now is for all communities, what needs to happen is to have a focus on preparedness to better detect, contain, and treat this new virus.
The world's Alana Gordon. Thank you for this update.
Thank you.
Alana mentioned South Korea. It's now on its highest alert level to try and contain the coronavirus. One of the country's biggest corporations is even telling workers to just stay home. And in the streets of South Korea's capital, Seoul, people are growing more and more concerned. Here's Kelly Kasulis with our story.
One week ago, there were only 30 confirmed cases of coronavirus in South Korea. On my subway ride to work this morning, the number was approaching 1,000. At this point, I'm starting to worry. But still, I'm surprised to see so few people out and about. Normally, there would be a lot of people coming through here, but it's actually kind of quiet right now. I decide to take a detour from work and look for a face mask.
So I've noticed that a lot of people have been walking into this pharmacy and coming out with bags and bags of face masks. So I'm going to go in and check the price and buy one myself. There's a lot of people in here. So I'm seeing there's only... Oh, there's a few kinds, but they're not even on the rack anymore. They're all just in boxes, so... They come in different sizes. Yeah, they only have children-sized ones left. Outside the pharmacy, I meet 26-year-old Kim Do-yup. He's standing in an alleyway with his face mask pulled down around his neck so he can have a smoke.
Can I keep smoking?
Yeah.
I ask him how coronavirus is having an impact on his life. Kim tells me he went to a funeral the other day, and several people didn't come because they were afraid of the coronavirus outbreak. Kim isn't the only one worried. Earlier this week, a middle-aged woman from a fringe religious group called Shincheonji refused to take a coronavirus test. She ended up spreading it to other church members. Suddenly, the southeastern city of Daegu had a massive outbreak. More cases started cropping up across the country. Won Jong-hoon, a 42-year-old office worker, tells me that nobody is safe, no matter where they live. Won says he thinks the number of cases will continue to go up, but he's confident that the Korean government will be able to handle the situation. But many South Koreans are worried and angry. Some are blaming that church in Daegu, and others are wagging their finger at China. In late January, more than 500,000 South Koreans signed an online petition. It called for a total ban of Chinese travelers. Anti-Chinese sentiment is also showing up in the real world.
So, for example, if you go outside and you go pass by a restaurant, you might see a sign saying no Chinese.
Felicia Istad is a researcher studying diversity policy at Korea University.
Instead of saying, like, no people having entered from China being allowed to visit the restaurant, it's specifically saying no Chinese, as in the people, and also online we can see condescending comments about Chinese people, and some of it is pretty aggressive, so it's definitely a problem.
Felicia says some of the blame game has to do with an age-old stereotype.
One of the perceptions is that Chinese people are less hygienic, and because when you're saying that, well, of course, this would happen in China due to the hygienic standards.
In South Korea, it seems like everyone is at least a little worried. While heading to another store to look for a face mask, I run into Sabrayan Shamam, a 27-year-old exchange student from Tunisia. I noticed you're wearing a face mask. Are you at all concerned about the coronavirus while you're visiting?
Yeah, because when I was in dormitory, they always have that notice, wear the mask, wash your hands always, so it gets in my mind, so every time when I go, I must wear it.
I also meet Kang Yun-jung, a 41-year-old office worker on the street. She says she canceled family trips to museums and movie theaters and decided to stay home with her kids last week. Kang says she's worried about the impact on the economy. She says it seems serious that businesses could be hurt. Before calling it quits, I try one last store in downtown Seoul to see if I can buy some face masks for myself. They're all sold out, she said. All right, well, we tried. So three places, no face mask. For the World, Kelly Kasulis, Seoul.
There's a lot of fear and anxiety right now around the coronavirus. It may seem like something unknown out there has gripped the planet, but not so fast. We've successfully confronted new diseases many times before. Just take a look at how Africa has been dealing with another global health emergency, the Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It has killed more than 2,200 people in the past year and a half. But today, many doctors are cautiously optimistic that Ebola is on the decline. Dr. Malam Kanta Issa is in the DRC, where he works for ALIMA, the Alliance for International Medical Action. Dr. Issa says they're at the tail end of the Ebola outbreak, but he warns we can't get too comfortable. Dr. Issa says we need to stay vigilant and that Africa will continue to need global financial and medical support to assure an outbreak doesn't flare up again. Public health officials say there are also lessons from the Ebola outbreak that can be applied to the spread of the coronavirus. We'll have that story for you tomorrow. The trial is over. Harvey Weinstein was found guilty today of rape and sexual assault. The verdict comes more than 2 years after the New York Times first published allegations about Weinstein and the Me Too movement erupted on social media. That movement, in which millions of women shared their stories of sexual assault and harassment, sparked a global reckoning. In nearly every region around the world, women have come forward. In Chile, huge crowds of women performed the protest song Un violador en tu camino, a rapist in your path. In France, journalist Sandra Mueller started the hashtag Balance ton porc, or expose your pig. It started when she tweeted that a former TV executive made humiliating advances towards her.
It just had no respect, and he thought I was a piece of steak, so a piece of pork, or I don't know, a piece of meat.
Mueller was later fined for defamation. Egyptian-American writer Mona El-Tahawi started the hashtag MosqueMeToo to give Muslim women an outlet to speak about sexual abuse they experienced while on the Hajj, the annual Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca. That hashtag went viral on Indonesian Twitter.
And many of the tweets would be saying, oh my goodness, I had no idea this was happening. Is this true? Is this happening? And then Indonesian women saying, yes, this happened to me. And then Muslim women in India and Pakistan began to tweet about this in Urdu. And then Muslim women in Turkey and Turkish and in the Middle East and Arabic and so on and so forth.
There were Me Too movements in Sweden, Nigeria, Haiti, Argentina, Japan. Harvey Weinstein, the man at the center of the U.S. Me Too movement, will be sentenced on March 11. He could face up to 25 years in prison. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. More than 20 years ago, bombs went off at two U.S. embassies in East Africa. This week, nearly 600 victims, including Americans and foreign nationals, are being represented at the U.S. Supreme Court. The case will determine if Sudan must pay billions of dollars in damages. The Trump administration is arguing on behalf of the victims in a case that continues to cast a shadow over U.S.-Sudanese relations today. The World's Halima Gikandi has our story.
On the morning of August 7th, 1998, Irene Karithi was rushing to finish a report on her computer. Suddenly, she heard a big bang.
And the bang to me was like, oh my God, what is that? Is that a transformer or something? Then I was like, I was worried like, oh my God, I hope the generator of the embassy turns up quick because I was not done with the report.
Karithi was working as an administrator at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, where she's from. And it was only when the ceiling started to wobble that she realized it wasn't another power outage. Then everything went dark and debris started falling.
I had commotion and I heard them talking quickly saying, get everybody out, get everybody out.
Minutes later, another bomb exploded at a different U.S. embassy, this one in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. In these two attacks, more than 200 people were killed, including 12 Americans. Thousands of people were injured. After years of investigations, a United States court found that Sudan was liable in the attacks because it provided material support to Al-Qaeda, which planned the bombings. In 2014, Sudan was ordered to pay more than $10 billion in damages to the victims. But the Sudanese government, under former President Omar al-Bashir, contested the judgment in court. Now the case has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. It will determine whether or not Sudan is liable to pay $4 billion in punitive damages. For someone like Irene Karithi, this case is about more than money. It's about holding countries responsible for sponsoring terrorism.
There is no price tag that can be put on a dead body or some people who lost their legs, people who lost their sight. There's no compensation.
The issue over compensation for victims of the terrorist attacks has become a major stumbling block between U.S. and Sudan. In the last 20 years, Sudan has partnered with the United States on countering terrorism. And in 2017, the U.S. lifted a number of sanctions on Sudan to acknowledge that partnership. Hilary Mossberg worked as a senior advisor on terrorism financing at the U.S. Treasury Department.
Within the Treasury Department and then also members of Congress over the years have been very heavily involved in Sudan policy issues.
But Mossberg says one set of sanctions still remains. Sudan's listing as a state sponsor of terrorism effectively restricts it from accessing debt relief. Last year, President Bashir was ousted from office. The country's new government has taken steps towards democratic reforms, but the U.S. has said that the decision to remove Sudan from the list is conditioned on outstanding issues. One of those issues is paying the victims of terrorist attacks. Some argue that Sudan needs to be removed from the U.S. terrorism list in order for the new transitional government to rebuild its economy. Sudan's new prime minister, Abdullah Hamdok, talked about that during a visit to Washington in December.
This issue has a lot of bearing on so many processes, not to mention the debt, investment, but also opening the country at large. But this is something, unless it is addressed, all these other processes will not take.
Earlier this month, Sudan announced it had reached a settlement with victims of the bombing of a U.S. Navy ship in 2000. That settlement is seen as key to Sudan's efforts to address some of the outstanding issues related to its listing as a state sponsor of terror. However, the victims of the U.S. Embassy bombings in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam are still waiting. For survivor Irene Karithi, these punitive damages would send an important message to any country that might sponsor terrorist attacks.
They'll think twice. They'll be insane not to think twice when they are doing those kind of acts, you know? Because, you know, you do this act and, you know, you pay for it and you pay dearly.
The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to make a judgment on the embassy bombings case later this year. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
In many places around the world, if you're a civil servant, you've got a stable job, a government paycheck, and a pension. But it comes with a catch. You go where you're needed. The southern African nation of Botswana is taking that to the extreme. Doctors, nurses, teachers, and engineers with the government are often sent to remote towns and villages. As the BBC's Shingai Nayoka reports, these professionals are not only filling a void, they're also bridging cultural divides.
Botswana's blue, white, and black striped flag is painted everywhere. School gates, concrete benches, bus stops. There's a sense of national pride here, tolerance, in a country where at least 8 major tribes and many more local languages coexist. I'm traveling to a town in the arid Kalahari to see how a government transfer program has contributed to integrating this country. The one thing that stands out about Hukunsi and the Kalahari is just how still everything is. It's one of those blink and you'll miss it town centres, not many people, the occasional car. In Botswana, civil servants can be posted anywhere and at any time, and often with little regard for ethnic origins, language and even personal preference. Natasha Banda is a government employee who was made to move here.
I received my letter. So I was like, where is Hukunsi? I literally cried at the ministry.
The 30-year-old nurse is also a self-confessed city girl from the east. I followed her as she went about her work in fashionable thick black stockings and high heels.
I came for a day, went through the village and then went back. I couldn't. It was too hot, too sandy. I like putting on heels.
Language was also a barrier to integration.
We've got old ladies coming there, old men. So you know how they are when it comes to culture. They will say everything in Sakhalakhadi. So I'll call someone to come and interpret, someone who has already been here. But eventually, slowly but surely, I got it. I think it made me more humble. More humble, more accepting.
Natasha even married into this tribe, putting down roots with a man from a neighboring village. Almost half of Botswana's workforce is made up of civil servants. However, not everyone is forced to move. Klokweng is a modern village on the outskirts of the capital, where goats and cattle move freely around suburban homes and streets and businesses. Ditso Makoko is a maths teacher who applied to transfer here from the more traditional and conservative north.
I've always been eager to see the difference between the north and the south.
Yes. So how many sides are there in a bag?
Teaching here has exposed him to different cultures from all over the country.
Some of the things that we see them as awkward, you will ask your colleague from the tribe, he or she will explain to you that, no, that's a normal thing in our culture, then you have to incorporate it in yourself so that you see things differently, so that you can be able to help the students without judging them in any way.
This year, Botswana celebrates 54 years of independence. Some say the transfer scheme, which on one hand moves people away from where they were born, has forged a bridge between local cultures and helped to create a more tolerant nation.
The BBC's Shengai Nayoka reporting there from Botswana. You're listening to The World. The bigger the rally, the better for President Trump. Today in India, 100,000 people packed the cricket stadium to hear the president.
America respects India, and America will always be faithful and loyal friends to the Indian people.
Trump's tour of India, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. It's no secret, the bigger the crowd, the better for President Trump. So today, during his two-day visit to India, Trump was in his element.
Namaste, Trump!
That's Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Today's rally was dubbed Namaste Trump, a phrase of welcoming.
Namaste.
Around 100,000 people packed a cricket stadium in the city of Ahmedabad to hear Trump.
America loves India. America respects India. And America will always be faithful and loyal friends to the Indian people.
At the rally, Trump announced a $3 billion defense deal. He also praised India as an inspiring economic giant.
It is all the more inspiring because you have done it as a democratic country. You have done it as a peaceful country. You have done it as a tolerant country. And you have done it as a great free country.
For Trump's visit, the Indian government even put up a new brick wall that blocks the view of a slum next door to the stadium. Indian officials say it was for security reasons. But Modi's critics say the wall is another way he's trying to hide the truth about what's really happening in India. The World's Rupa Shenoy has more on that.
Trump and Modi are good friends, and that's not unusual. India is an important strategic trade and military partner. President Obama was friends with Modi, too. But Trump and Modi took it to another level 5 months ago in Texas when they held hands and praised each other at a rally called Howdy Modi. And even though Trump and Modi haven't settled a crucial trade agreement, their mutual love fest continued today.
Prime Minister Modi, you are not just the pride of Gujarat. You are living proof that with hard work and devotion, Indians can accomplish anything, anything at all, anything they want.
But as Modi and Trump's friendship has grown, so has the chorus of troubling reports coming out of Kashmir. That's the disputed region between India and Pakistan. India's part of Kashmir is guaranteed the freedom to make its own laws under India's constitution. But Modi's Hindu nationalist government revoked that right last summer. He sent in troops, imposed a curfew, and for several months, a communications blackout. People demonstrated, and protesters and bystanders said they were beaten by police. Next, Modi's government passed a law providing a pathway to citizenship for some religious minorities, but not Muslims. Again, setting off protests. Trump's own State Department has said that law is divisive. This is Assistant Secretary for Human Rights Robert Destro at a House hearing in September.
That seems like a pretty bald attempt to use religion as a lever to split the society. Now, why anybody would do that, I don't understand.
Now, if India goes ahead with plans to hold a national registry where officials check everyone's documents, many Muslims worry they'll be declared illegal migrants.
If this happens, then it will be a disaster.
Aman Wadood is a civil rights attorney in Assam, a state in far northeastern India, where a national registry has already been started.
The same thing what happened in Assam will happen all over the country.
Wadood represents people who he says have been labeled illegal migrants, even though they had documentation to show they were citizens.
They have the papers. Randomly, they are accused of being illegal migrant. Even army officers have been accused of being illegal migrant. They have been detained.
He says thousands of people have already been thrown into detention centers in Assam. Many are stuck there because India doesn't have enough judges to hear their cases.
Once you are detained, you don't have right to parole. You will be indefinitely detained if you do not get any kind of relief from the higher courts.
Students from some of India's premier universities have been protesting against what's happening in Assam and Kashmir. Gruesome scenes of police brutality have been shared online. Jacinta Kerketa is an indigenous poet in northeastern India.
Life is becoming worse.
She compares what's happening in India today to the early stages of Nazi fascism. The Trump visit unnerves her because Jair Bolsonaro, the right-wing president of Brazil, came to see Modi just last month. They signed major trade and security deals.
When people see, like, Trump is with Modi, Bolsonaro is with Modi, people feel like, why all over the world fascist government are why coming together?
She asks why fascist governments are coming together. Her answer is that these leaders are validating each other and helping each other build up their credibility on the world stage.
So Trump, I think, kind of gives Modi covering fire.
Samar Halankar is a former editor of one of the big Indian newspapers, the Hindustan Times. He says he left mainstream media because editors are allowing the Modi government to censor stories.
We've seen a spate of imprisonments. We've seen a lot of police brutality. And across India, we are seeing a dramatic deterioration in the rule of law.
And if Trump isn't reelected this year, Larnkar says Modi may face harsher scrutiny from the U.S.
I think it's safe to say that there'd be considerable pressure on the Indian government on a whole variety of issues related to civil liberties.
For now, U.S. State Department officials say India hasn't allowed them inside Kashmir to see for themselves. Suhag Shukla, executive director of the Hindu American Foundation in Washington, D.C., says Modi enjoys broad support despite protests by his critics. She says that if minorities were being persecuted in India, they would be fleeing the country.
You're not seeing any mass exodus of religious minorities out of India. In fact, you're actually seeing religious minorities from neighboring countries trying to come into India.
Shukla's extended family is in Gujarat, where Modi was chief minister. She says Modi's made India a better place to live.
So I've seen over the past 20 years the remarkable levels of development, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's cleaning up, whether it's providing public toilets.
Shukla acknowledges she's speaking from an American perspective. But that's a really important perspective for Modi, who's courted the Indian diaspora like no previous Indian leader. But the closer Modi gets to Trump, the more Modi might be questioned by Indian Americans, says Sanghe Mishra, an assistant professor of political science at Drew University. Because in the U.S., he says, most Indian Americans vote Democratic.
It absolutely opens up the possibility of people who understand who Trump is and what kind of politics he's representing. They will also understand what Modi stands for because of the kind of closeness that they want to demonstrate.
In other words, Indian Americans who criticize Trump because they believe he targets minorities, they might start to question Modi because of his very public friendship with the president. Activism by Indian Americans has increased in recent months, and Mishra says it's gotten Modi's attention. We delve into that tomorrow. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The crisis in northern Syria is approaching a scale that has not been seen throughout the nearly 10-year Syrian civil war. That's according to the United Nations official who oversees humanitarian needs in Syria, Mark Cutts.
If airstrikes and shelling move any further into that area, we are no doubt going to see a real bloodbath, a real massacre of civilians in that area.
Millions of people in northern Syria are trapped. They face advancing Syrian forces to the south, to the north, the Turkish border, which is closed to them. Idlib, the main city in the region, has nearly doubled in size with civilians fleeing other parts of Syria. The UN estimates that 3 million people are crammed in the city. The BBC's Quentin Somerville has this report from Idlib province on the dire conditions there.
Most of this village, Darat Izza, has been abandoned. We've stopped by the White Helmets, the Syrian Civil Defence Force, the rescue squads. You just heard about a Russian or regime plane in the air, and that had everybody on alert, but it's not here, it's further away in Idlib city. But we're not far from the regime front lines. They're only about 5 kilometres from where I am right now. So as I walk and look around this town, it's mostly empty apart from the White Helmets. The noticeable thing about this place now, not just the men, the armed men going around on motorcycles because it makes them less of a target, is that the threat feels much closer. Ismail from Aleppo is a White Helmets volunteer. He says the situation here is hopeless.
If they advance on the ground, I will not be here anymore. I will try to go out of this hell because all the world let us down.
What happens if the regime comes here?
The biggest and horrific and horrible massacre will be here in northwest Syria. Maybe it will be the horrific massacre in this history because of the millions, because of the big number of the civilians. Nowhere to go.
We pass through fields and olive groves and head towards Idlib city. There's hardly a place without tents or makeshift shelters. It feels like the entire province is on the move. But in the city itself, people are frozen in place, some too poor to flee. Here on the edge of Idlib city, there's a half-finished building. It has a roof but no walls, but there are dozens of families, the displaced, who've taken up home here. They've put up tarpaulin to try and keep out the rain, and it's raining heavily now. And from this very sad and desperate home, you can hear the shelling just outside Idlib city. When I walk up the stairs, I realise that, in fact, there are 26 families here. Inside there are blankets and tarpaulins which are hanging up from ropes to make rooms, really. There's no heating, there's no light. They're burning what they can to stay warm. The weather's terrible. But they've no alternative. It's either stay at home and risk capture by the regime, or head north, where the camps are already crowded. Overcrowded, there's no more room. Or eke out what space you can here in Idlib City. In the basement, the gloom is lifted by a small battery-powered light. Adnan and his wife, Asama, dust off a few broken chairs and offer us tea. I ask them why they haven't left for the border yet.
We have no transport, no money, and there is no shelter there. Where will we live? If we buy tents, it's even more difficult. And because so many people have fled, there is no room. The border is full now. We will not go until the last moment. It's impossible to buy tents.
The situation is hard. Living is hard. We are all trapped here. We keep warm by burning plastic and rubbish. The children are getting sick from the smoke, and the women can't go out. It's like being in a prison.
It's pitch dark now and still raining. Outside, there's the occasional boom of artillery in the distance. The regime is less than 6 miles away. I can hear the children playing behind the tarpaulin walls. Their parents and grandparents are there too, doubtless fretting if they have it in them to make one final escape before Bashar al-Assad's forces arrive to take the last corner of rebel-held Syria.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville in Idlib, Syria. Carnival in Rio de Janeiro was rocking this weekend and continues through Wednesday. And though he's not a resident of Rio anymore, Sergio Mendes still feels the event big time. His big hit in the 60s, Mas Que Nada, became Mendes' calling card, a song about the contagious rhythm of samba. For years now, the Brazilian musician and composer has lived in Los Angeles, but he's still breathing the rhythms of home.
Yeah, come on.
The first single on the new Sergio Mendes release is Sabor do Rio, or The Flavor of Rio, and he's got rapper Common giving us his take on the Brazilian city.
Feel the sunshine, yeah, summertime. Little brew, a little bit, a little wine. We feeling good now, in the hood now. Rio de Janeiro, understood now. Coming from Chicago, this is Common. I'm in the place with my man, Sergio. This is how the words go. This is how we rocking in the circle, universal though.
Yeah, I do feel it. I guess if you can't physically be in Rio at Carnival this week, the tune does a pretty good job of setting the mood. The new single from Sergio Mendes and Common, that's Sabor do Rio.
Live music, we in sync. A lot of people doing what we can. Don't think too long, don't think too wrong. When it comes to this show, you loving that song. Now we can go strong. Look at the palm trees and feel the breeze.
I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. The founder of WikiLeaks appeared in court today in London. Julian Assange faced his first day of an extradition hearing. Washington wants Assange to stand trial in the U.S. They argue that he violated the Espionage Act by obtaining and publishing secret military and diplomatic documents. From London, The World's Orla Barry has more.
Supporters of Julian Assange made themselves heard outside of Woolwich Crown Court in rainy London. Inside the building, lawyers acting for the US government opened their case in favour of extraditing the founder of WikiLeaks. Chants from the protesters could be heard throughout the proceedings. The courthouse is right next to Belmarsh Prison. The high security facility is where Assange has been held for the last 10 months. His father, John Shipton, attended today's hearing. I spoke with him over the weekend and asked about his son's health.
Well, as you would expect, after 10 years of psychological torture, of abrogation of human rights, of the Crown Prosecuting Service, not that well.
Julian Assange was arrested in London last April. He'd been living in the Ecuadorian embassy here for 7 years. He sought asylum in Ecuador to avoid extradition to Sweden, where he faced allegations of sexual assault. Assange has always denied those allegations, and that investigation has since been dropped. Last year, Ecuador revoked his asylum status, and cameras rolled when a heavily bearded and somewhat dazed-looking Assange was hauled out of the embassy by British police. He could be heard shouting, "UK must resist." At the time of his arrest, Assange was charged with skipping bail here in the UK. On the very same day, the US issued an extradition warrant, and Assange's lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, said she was not one bit surprised.
Mr. Assange was arrested this morning at about 10 o'clock at the Ecuadorian embassy by British police. We've today received a warrant and a provisional extradition request from the United States, alleging that he has conspired with Chelsea Manning in relation to the materials that were published by WikiLeaks in 2010.
Chelsea Manning is the US intelligence analyst who was arrested for providing a massive trove of confidential documents and videos to WikiLeaks. The documents related to US military activity in Iraq and Afghanistan. Initially, the US accused Assange of conspiring to hack into a Pentagon computer network. Then later last year, 17 new charges against him were filed for violating the Espionage Act. To some, Assange is a campaigner for truth. Here's fashion designer Vivian Westwood speaking at a protest march for Assange in London last weekend.
Julian is a victim of illegal abuse sanctioned by government. It is not a crime to publish American war crimes. It is in the public interest.
To others, though, Assange is a publicity seeker who's recklessly released classified information. His personality divides even his supporters. British journalist Roy Greenslade met Assange at a university lecture he was giving.
She came in surrounded by a group of people, looked like a king entering his court. I thought it was a bit of grandstanding. But the interesting thing about that was when he actually spoke, what he said was so interesting and so important that the substance overcame the style.
But in court today, lawyers for the US government described Assange as a dangerous man. They say WikiLeaks put the lives of dissidents and US partners in Afghanistan and Iraq at risk. They also argued that specific sources named in classified US documents that were released by WikiLeaks have since disappeared. Lawmakers from 12 European countries were in the courtroom listening today. So too were representatives of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange himself. I asked his father, John Shipton, what impact he thinks extradition to the US would have on his son.
It'll be catastrophic. A tragedy for Julian, a tragedy for his family, and a catastrophe for free speech, free association, a disaster.
The hearing is divided into two separate parts. Legal arguments will be heard this week, then 3 weeks of witness testimony are scheduled for the middle of May. But activist Lindsay German says the case is likely to go on for far longer.
Got a long, long way to go, and there will be appeals, I'm sure, whatever the decisions there are. So this is, we've got quite a long process. I'm not being complacent about it.
Assange, who's 48 years old now, is facing charges that could put him behind bars for the rest of his life. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Not long ago, Disney released a movie about a high school science teacher who finally gets a chance to play Major League Baseball at age 35.
But sometimes,
hey coach, you want to throw?
When you least expect it, dreams come back to life.
It is a touching, true story. Then this weekend, something similar happened. 42-year-old David Ayers was sitting in the stands at a hockey game in Toronto, the Toronto Maple Leafs versus the Carolina Hurricanes. During the first period,
turns around, fed the puck in front, the goaltender's down, wiped out by his own man, friendly fire in the net.
The Carolina goalie, James Reimer, goes down with an injury, so the backup goalie, Peter Mrazek, steps in. Then,
knocked the puck down, Jason Spezza's long reach, oh, what a collision here!
Mrazek goes down. So now Carolina has no one to play goalie, and that's when 42-year-old David Ayers gets the text message, suit up.
When I saw the text message, these guys playing with me right now? Like, I'm going in? And then they came in and they said, get ready, we're going to put you in. So
Ayers works as a building manager at a Toronto ice rink where he drives a Zamboni. But he also practices with the Maple Leafs and is Toronto's emergency goalie. And here's where things get weird. According to the rules of the National Hockey League, the home team, in this case Toronto, has to have a backup to the backup goalie available to both teams. But for these emergency guys actually getting in a game, they don't expect that to happen. Ayers had been an emergency goalie for 8 years, but never got his blades on the ice during a game. So naturally, when the 42-year-old Zamboni driver skated out onto the ice in front of nearly 20,000 fans, the commentators noticed some nerves.
What could be going through your mind right now? And you know what?
Ayers allowed two quick goals on two shots. For you hockey novices, that is as bad as it gets. But then Ayers says Carolina's starting goalie, James Reimer, gave him some good advice.
He said, you know, just have fun. This is your time. You know, you're not. This isn't your full-time job, but you're out here and you have fun. You know what you're doing. He said, just be a goalie. Make saves. So it was good. I settled down in the third period, and he came in after, and he was pumped up.
Not only did Ayers settle down, he nailed it. He made seven saves in the third period. The home crowd went nuts, even though they were actually cheering for the visiting team. And Ayers helped the Hurricanes win 6-3.
Keep the puck, David. You've just got a National Hockey League victory. 6-3, Carolina. Oh, man, look at that reaction.
Ayers became the oldest goalie in NHL history to win his regular season debut. He also got paid $500 for his services. And who knows, I don't want to jinx it, maybe Disney will buy the rights to his story, too. We come to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.